We're
but
talking
hair
about
is not a part of your DNA. Otherwise, when Jason
resurrects, yes, it is.
When Jason resurrects, he would have hair. It is not a part of him at all. It is an extra byproduct of the body.
Technically speaking, he does have hair, but it's hair follicles that haven't grown out yet.
But why are they growing at all?
Sex appeal. Sex appeal. I said sex.
But still, no, it's appeal. It just doesn't. It doesn't make any sense on a magical scale.
You're not human. That's hurtful. Are you that guy with the evil powers? I think everyone has dark urges. It's kind of my thing.
Welcome, everyone, to the first episode of the He Who Writes the Monsters podcast. I'm D. Allen.
And I'm Donnie B. Dude, it is so good to be here with you. We've been working on this for quite some time now. We've been talking about doing it. And here it is, first episode of the podcast. We're going to start talking about the He Who Fights with Monsters series by the one and only Shirtaloon, a.k.a. Travis Deverell. Tell us a little bit about it. What is this series?
So, now, you were the first person that introduced me to this series, and I can't thank you enough for that.
Anytime.
First off, it's a typical isekai, you know, at least on the surface. It starts off as just your typical isekai. Dude finds himself magically transported to another world. But a little bit of the real world history behind this thing. So the entire project actually started as Shirtaloon's creative side project. Given that his job at the time was just to be like a website article writer, whatever it was that he was doing, he wanted a creative outlet, so he decided to, you know, start working on this series, which he was publishing multiple chapters a week on a website called The Royal Road, and it gained a big following there. And as soon as it did, Audible picked it up and was like, hey, that'd be great. And as of right now, there are 11 books in the series. He is still publishing chapters, and he is not showing any signs of stopping.
He is not. And at the time of this recording, Heath Miller is currently recording for the Audible series, book 12. It's going to drop here in a couple of months. I am too excited about that.
Yes, it is 2 months from the time that we are recording this that book 12 comes out, and I am hype. I have already done my books 1 through 11 listen through in preparation for us doing the podcast.
Yeah.
So I am fresh up on the series and eagerly anticipating book 12.
Yeah, it is going to be so good. I cannot wait. We're a little ahead of ourselves, though. Let's start with book 1. Let's go through this. As we go through the series, we're going to be breaking down the book, little couple chapters at a time. And we'll talk about it. We'll break it down as it pertains to the greater Monsters universe. And we'll talk about some fun stuff. We're just going to have some fun with it.
Hell yeah. Now, I have a question for you, Donnie.
I have an answer for you, Davey.
What would be the first thought in your mind if you just woke up naked in a hedge maze?
Dude, my first thought would just be, what? Because, you know, this is not a situation that you can possibly prepare for. You know, you go to bed at night, you know, like Jason was, up all night playing video games, stumbles into bed somehow, and then all of a sudden you're naked, you're in the grass. How could you prepare for that? It's crazy, man.
Yeah, and I mean, and the loss of those Darth Vader boxers, like, those things are fake.
Heartbreaking. He's on the Empire side.
Sad day. And so Jason, he is literally just some normal freaking dude. He works basically at, like, Staples.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's just normal, boring guy. So, waking up in a hedge maze, probably weird, because who the hell even has a hedge maze?
A couple of people. Not a lot I can imagine.
I know of the Stanley Hotel. That's about it.
I'm sure there's two owners to that hotel. Two people. there's a...
Give you that.
I think there are hedge mazes scattered here and there, but I don't know of anybody who just has one for their house. Trust me, if I could, I would absolutely put a hedge maze in my backyard. Then I would have to worry about people showing up in them naked, I guess.
I'm gonna stop recording and go build a hedge maze.
Where are you going? Let's go. You have 15 minutes.
Dang. All right. So breaking it down, though, I mean, at the end of the day, this is your typical isekai intro. Mm-hmm. You know, a regular dude gets magically transported into another world, and that is the situation that Jason Asano finds himself in. He wakes up butt-ass naked and laying face down in the grass in some completely unfamiliar place, and he's got a lot to figure out, and some of the first things I think he needs to figure out is the fact that a screen just popped up in front of him indicating that he has powers and abilities.
He does. Well, the potential for powers and abilities.
Right.
He's got a few racial gifts, just your basic, you know, map inventory, quest system type thing you'd find in any video game. And a lot of messages popping up telling him he could have powers, but he doesn't.
but he doesn't.
So this is really just where we get into the first bit of the magic system that we see in this series. This interface, as we know, is going to be his guide through this world as an outworlder. Going to be very clear as the books continue that it is basically a video game screen, which I love about this series. It is just D&D meets video games. It's basically a book about Baldur's Gate, if it was in another universe.
No, it's like if Baldur's Gate met like Sword Art Online.
Oh yeah, 100%.
Yeah,
and I love every minute of it. He does really well.
Yeah, he does. It's a brief little aside that Jason has about hallucinating because he's got, you know, all of these screens popping up and he's manipulating with his mind, and from a person just blankly standing there and having this stuff happen, like, yeah, I would very much assume I have been altered in some very insane way, which in fact he has been altered in some very insane way.
He has. This is a lot for him to take in. You know, he's still dealing with being naked in the grass in a strange place. And before he really has time to digest that, now he's got a screen telling him he's a character. Giving him all of the potential unlocks he can do before he really has a chance to do anything. And before he really has time to digest that, he has this quest system pop up telling him to go forward and explore this hedge maze. And he's really not able to process all of this information that keeps coming in. Now, this is a very confusing time, and I would assume full mental breakdown, possibly hallucinations. Who knows?
I mean, the list is long there, that's for sure.
I do have a question for you.
What's that?
With all of this going on, I understand that not top of Jason's priority list, but he is completely hairless.
Right. That so is my, true.
My question for you is, why? Right? Because we know that when your body traverses the astral, you know, your soul goes through, makes a new body for itself out of magic. That's what happened to him here. Every time Jason resurrects, he's completely hairless. Right? So his hair is not a part of his soul. It's just extra holding on.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, as he's mostly magical, and especially at higher ranks when your body is completely magical, you still grow hair. And hair, as we know, is just a byproduct of your body's consumption, right? Extra protein and keratin going through your body. It gets excreted into fingernails and hair.
Sure.
Not necessary, just a waste byproduct. Why do essence users have hair? I don't get it.
Two words. Sex appeal.
Yeah, but that's not strictly necessary to your body.
No, hold that. It's not strictly necessary. We have descriptions of silver and gold rank characters that are like a supermodel and Superman levels of freaking sexy. And despite, you know, thinking about it, or despite not thinking about it, hair plays a huge role in sex appeal. You know, no hair in certain places could be sexy. A lot of hair in certain places could be not sexy. And vice versa. And in general, you know, like long flowing hair on women, you know, nice structured hair on men, it plays into sex appeal. And I think there's a beauty element to rank progression. So why would hair not be an element of that, so that the magic could just set aside a little magic just for hair growth?
Right, but where are you getting the keratin from to create your hair and your fingernails, right? Because your body, as a high level essence user, body's completely magical. It uses 100% of your consumption intake, zero waste products. That's why you get more beautiful as you rank up, because you're shaving off a little bit more of the unnecessary bits of your soul and your body.
Sure.
Right? Hair is not a part of the soul, e.g. Jason's naked. So it's not like a fundamental building block of your soul. So your hair is completely magical.
Mm-hmm.
And growing inherently,
yeah,
without any input from you, without any usage of byproduct from your body, it's just kind of there with no explanation as to why.
Sex appeal.
But that doesn't make sense. Why does magic care about your sex?
Why does it make them sexier? You know what I mean? Like, same difference.
Because it's turning them into a better version of themselves, right? Like, yeah. Jason's chin gets less pronounced.
So what you're saying is... Being completely hairless would be like your ideal form of sexiness?
With the way that the magic system is described in this series, it should be. Right? It's like you change your facial structure a little bit when you rank up to become more appealing. You're not creating a brand new face that wasn't attached to your body in the first place. It's already there. It's part of your soul. It's going to be there. Hair is completely unnecessary to the body. It is strictly and only a waste product of the body.
Untrue.
Therefore, it shouldn't
Untrue.
Be.
So we used to be a lot hairier of a creature.
Right.
We lost that over the years. The things that remained, the elements of, on average, body hair that remained are armpits, pubic hair, and head hair, correct? Armpits and pubic
arms
hair,
and chest
both
and back.
Sure, but essentially though, all of those, the ones that are main, because arms, chest, and back are, you know, not everybody has massive hair. I'm talking about where big patches of hair grow on generally everybody.
Right.
It's because like so those patches specifically, like armpit, pubic patches, all that good stuff, that is to mitigate sweat. That's to, you know, essentially keep things out of the area.
Right.
And we kept our head hair, literally, genetically, for sex appeal. So, in the essence user DNA, it's still being selected for. Therefore, the body still views it as a necessity, regardless. Because it still gets selected for in breeding.
I mean, on a normal rank perspective, yes. Essence users don't sweat, so they don't have to worry about that. They don't get hot. They don't get cold often.
But again, we're talking about...
hair is not a part of your DNA. Otherwise, when Jason resurrects...
Yes, it is!
When Jason resurrects, he would have hair. It is not a part of him at all. It is an extra byproduct of the body.
Technically speaking, he does have hair, but it's hair follicles that haven't grown out yet.
But why are they growing at all?
Sex appeal. Sex appeal. I said sex.
But still. No, it's... It just doesn't... It doesn't make any sense on a magical scale.
Meh.
Essence users maybe have hair made of magic. That's where we're ending with this.
I mean, I'm cool with it. DNA and magic sounds good to me.
No DNA, just magic.
Nope, all DNA. No magic.
No DNA.
Perfect. The DNA has been perfected. So, of course, they're going to have perfect hair.
They probably don't have DNA. Jason doesn't have any DNA right now. He has blood. He has no organs. He has no internal...
We are going to set this aside for when we get to talk to Sherdaloon about this.
Yes.
Mr. Loon, we've got answers.
We need answers. We've got questions.
Right.
Oh.
Shit.
All right. Put that on the list. We'll ask Sherdaloon.
Put it on the list. All right.
Speaking of Jason, let's get back to this. He's got a quest and an inventory system, and he's naked. Where's he going to go from here?
Where's he going with this? Well, he's got a nifty little map ability to tell him. So... he opens up his map, and it kind of functions like, you know, any other video game map, kind of like Legend of Zelda or any other. Open up a menu, and you see where you're at, and, you know, blurred out everywhere you haven't been, in little grayscale everywhere you have been. He gets the name of where he's at, and he is at the Vein Estate. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun.
But not really, because that means nothing to him right now.
No, it doesn't.
As he's going about exploring the maze, he is also kind of playing around, checking out his character sheet, finding out he's got abilities and whatnot. He's got a few different racial abilities, astral affinities. So he has the ability to like play around with astral forces, or at least be influenced by them and influence them. He's got outworld abilities because he's no longer human. He's an outworlder. You know, and so during this section, though, we actually get one of the biggest pieces of foreshadowing in the series, because as he's looking through his character sheet and all this stuff, he finds the World Phoenix token, which, again, at this moment means nothing to him. But we know that later in the series, the World Phoenix token ends up being a very, very pivotal element to his story, as it's, you know, how he gets his resurrections and whatnot. And in this moment, I actually really like how Sherdaloon, like, describes characters, because he's really good at these character introductions as well as really fleshing out the world of his characters. And even, you know, the backgrounds and even the smallest little things, and I really... really enjoy that. Talking about his family and, you know, how he doesn't speak Japanese, but he should. It's cool to see that level of depth here. He's such a good writer that it's literally like this great piece of character work that's just kind of willy-nilly thrown in there in the middle of, you know, it's like a little soliloquy in his head, but it's like really good character work, you know?
It is, too. I absolutely love how he describes his characters and builds up that backstory. You get a lot of information. This is for every character that we see, that we follow around in the series. We see a lot of just context-based backstory, so you assume a lot about Jason and his old life and his family just from how he feels about them, you know?
Right.
And it's absolutely genius.
Absolutely. And another thing I love about Sherdaloon is his ability to reference and work in other little random works. And in fact, the first literary reference that at least I could catch in the entire series is referencing Robert Frost's The Road Not Taken poem, because he finds himself at a split path in the hedge maze, and he's like, well, it's no yellow wood, but I'm going to Robert Frost this thing anyway, and just picks a random direction, which actually, if you've read the poem, is not doing a Robert Frost at all, because the whole point was taking the road less traveled, and he just takes a random road, so...
Yeah. Maybe, but it looked a little less worn than the rest of them.
No, fair enough. Doesn't specify. So that's a reference that's very on its face, literally, like it references the author and everything, but throughout the entire thing. But I love just little references to things, and I love watching for them. And I mean, I've found Douglas Adams, I've found Tolkien, I found all sorts of stuff referenced in this series that it's really fun. Or at least they seem like references to it.
Yeah, there's definitely some where it gives you a direct reference, like with Robert Frost. And then there's a lot of times where, you know, I'm listening to it on Audible and I'll hear a line, I'll be like, wait a minute.
Wait a minute.
And it'll remind you of different works. I get a lot of Tolkien and I get a lot of Adams.
Yeah, 100%. 100% for sure.
Yeah, the way he works it in is just amazing. And really, it's just for geeks like us.
Also, and this is just my own personal micro theory, I really think he likes Little Nicky, the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because in this first book, he gets hit in the face with a shovel. And then later, we are told that healing potion tastes like strawberry schnapps, which is what Adrian in Little Nicky drinks. He's drinking strawberry schnapps all the time. And I'm like, shovel face and strawberry schnapps, there's no way that's not a Little Nicky reference.
Right.
Like, so that's my headcanon, and I'm gonna choose to believe that. So moving on from that section of good writing, we have another fun little section of good writing indicating the first monster attack, because he gets a new quest. No shirt, no shoes, no service, and this quest is to take out 10 lesser monsters that pop up in this maze, with the bonus objective of figuring out why they're in that maze in the first place, and it will award him a shirt and shoes.
So
that is pretty cool, until the first of these lesser monsters appears and literally latches itself onto his head.
Yes. A soccer ball sized potent hamster, as it were.
Yeah.
And this scene, coming back reading through it again after having completed the series, is really funny, because we get two very cool visuals here. The first, obviously, the hamster, just imagining a giant hamster and then latching it onto his face.
Right.
I enjoyed that more than I should have, I think, because after reading through the series, you see Jason as this guy who is out there in the astral fighting the great astral beings, the pinnacle of all power in the astral, and right here he almost gets taken out by a hamster.
Facts. And actually, there's another element to this that I picked up on here. So when the hamster latches onto his head, he literally rips it off of his head, right? Rips a chunk of skin out of his head, this whole thing. And when I read it, after having gone through the whole series, I read that as, like, you know, kind of indicative of how he is in battle in general. He is willing to take the pain and sacrifice himself, you know, to achieve the outcome. And, you know, even though in this moment it's chaotic, short, and whatever, it's literally just ripping something off his head, but, like, it is a very Jason thing to do. Like, he is in trouble. Oh, shit, I've got to rip it off my head, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and barring any potential more damage to himself. And we see that multiple times with crazy stuff that happens where he's just like, well, the only way to do it is to basically almost kill myself. So yeah. I'm going to do it.
Doesn't even think about it.
And so I think, you know, for me, I picked this up as Shirtaloon kind of pointing at the fact that, like, yeah, this is going to be a thing that he does.
And frequently.
Yeah.
He does. He gets beaten up by these monsters pretty good in this maze. He uses a lot of healing on Yuen. And that's basically just his reaction to everything. Fight and kill. Doesn't matter the pain.
That's true. Now, you mentioned Unguent, but you did not mention that he achieved getting this Unguent by looting the hamster, which in his weird, potentially hallucinatory state was even more the weird that he killed a creature that attacked him, and then all of a sudden he has a nice little sealed tin of like medicine.
And knowing how the looting system works, you know, basically when you loot something, it just takes all the remaining magic that creature had and it condenses it into useful items. And so he needed healing unguent, and his looting ability gave him healing unguent, which is incredibly convenient for Jason and will continue to be throughout the entire series.
And then on top of that, though, what I actually really enjoyed about this, all the back and forth, there's another cool little character moment, where he mentions like the unguent reminding him of like the same little rusty can that he would have seen in his grandma's house, you know, that she would use. And what kind of got me is like, that was like a core memory for me, because my grandma absolutely had a, you know, like little tiger balm healing ointment jar, little metal tin that was always in the bathroom drawer, and she would use that all the time. And 100%. You know, and it's kind of funny because it's one of those like things that he'll write, these like incredibly relatable little things that you would never think about, but then you're like, yeah, man, like I've got that little tin of unguent. That makes sense. Right. It's kind of neat.
Yes, very relatable to the reader. I love it.
And what's kind of interesting with it is you also get another deeper look into Jason's life on Earth, further expanding on the fact that he's half Japanese, in that it's his Australian grandmother that has the tin of unguent, whereas his Japanese grandmother would, like, do no such thing, very prim and proper lady, who we do get to meet much later in the series, and that is fantastic. She is such a good character as well. But again, like I said, it, you know, like, we work that relatable thing in, and then we get, but, like, we get this relatable moment, but then we also get, like, character depth in that little relatable moment, and it's just, it is just such good writing every single time. I love it.
Yes.
So with the looting power, on top of getting the unguent and coins and other stuff, he also received something called a monster core. And what kind of got me and tripped me up here was when he picks this core up, it does not state that it's a consumable. And I was like, yo, like, if it would have stated that that core was consumable, he might have, like, screwed up his, like, magic progression from the get-go. And I kind of feel like the interface saved him a little bit by saying that, hey, no, this core isn't consumable. It's just a thing for making magic items in ritual circles.
Right. Well, I think we, if it was a consumable, I'm sure Rufus would have explained what monster cores are a lot sooner. Just because once he gets all of his essences, he could be like, hey, I can use this thing. I'm going to use that too. And Rufus would be like, no, don't. But I do think this is a little bit of magical intervention on his interface's behalf.
Right. Now another thought that I had though was that could it be that because he doesn't have essences, it doesn't register itself as consumable because he can't consume it yet because he has nothing that it would grow.
It's very possible. This is it's listing it as a non-consumable because he can't consume it right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it's just listed as like an item for, you know, ritual magic basically.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's kind of a here or there. Like either like because he's, you know, not an essence user yet, it doesn't say that. Or yeah. Another possibility is that a lesser monster core can't be used for progression. Maybe it's just there's not enough magic in there to do anything.
That would make a lot of sense.
Well, yeah, add it to the list of certain questions.
A lot of the ritual diagrams that we see being drawn out throughout this series use lesser monster cores in a powdered form.
Powdered lesser monster core. That's right. Yeah, they do maybe specify it's just lesser for
crafting. Yeah.
Huh. It very well could be.
The only thing you can do with him.
Because then later, when he does encounter the monster core, like, Rufus, like, freaks the hell out. Like, you did... Wait, what? You know, like, no, I didn't use it. Like, oh, thank God.
Yeah.
So, while he's, you know, looking at the core and discovers that, at the moment, like everything else, it is useless. He puts it away, and he's like... Well, I'm in a video game. Or I'm dying. And then his thoughts shift to his sister and his niece finding his body. And yet again, this is like another cool moment where if you've read the series, you're like, damn, this is Emmy and Erica being mentioned in chapter 2 or chapter 3. Like, what? Like, so early. And like, you know, when you first read through, like, they're just generic sister and niece archetypes, but then to listen back through and know who Erica and Emmy are, then like it made it like that much sadder listening to it the second time, because I was like, oh, I thought about Emmy finding his body, and I was like, oh no,
not Emmy. Yeah, you don't have a lot of context for who they are at this point on your first read through, and then after you get through the series, you're attached to these characters.
Yeah.
And it hits so much harder.
Yeah. And I'll be real with you. I feel like Jason has ADHD.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely he does.
Because, I mean, this whole first few chapters, his mind is literally just going one thing to the next, to the next, to the next. Because literally the next paragraph after he's thinking about like, oh, man, my sister and niece finding me dead. That kind of sucks. And then he just pulls out a coin and he's just like, ooh, shiny coin. Like,
yeah.
Like, dude is so ADD. It cracks me up.
Yes. And that's his thing through the whole series. He is so easily distracted, mostly talking about food. But yeah, he can get off track really quick and his mind switches gears really fast. He's got to have some form of ADHD. Happening. Like, it could be brain trauma, but I think it's mostly ADHD.
And like, and the funny thing is, like, what made me kind of come to this term was I'm looking at my notes that I wrote for this episode, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like that doesn't even seem related. And then I'm like looking back through, and I'm like, no, that's the next paragraph. Like, that's the next thing that happens. Like. But it's such non sequitur. It's like so ADD. So either Jason is ADD or Shirtaloon is ADD. One or the other.
Well, I'm sure if Shirtaloon's ADD, so would Jason be.
Yeah. And vice versa, maybe.
Possibly.
Could be. So as he's examining the coin, though, he discovers that it's got his own face on it. So minted by him.
Yeah.
And... which is kind of a funny thing. It causes him problems later on. But I think it's also kind of a cool representation of the fact that money is kind of never one of his issues in this series. Like, dude is basically just strapped up at all times, loaded, you know, like, doesn't even matter. Like, money is, like, essentially a non-issue for him. And, I mean, he literally basically prints his own. Actually, later in the series, he literally can print his own money.
Yeah.
His own fake spirit coins. Like, it's insane.
He is the richest socialist I've ever seen.
He really is. But yeah, and so it's kind of a cool representation, and I think that's what I like about these four chapters, the first four chapters of this book, is there is really so much that happens or happens to Jason, or that he does or whatever, that is like directly referenced in these first four chapters. Like, so many things are referenced here that seem like just random things, and then later on they all get like found out to be like some other important thing.
Yeah.
And it's just really cool. The level of depth I think that Sherdaloon has when he's writing this, it's so good. He really thought this stuff out.
He did. The amount of forethought that we get, like the World Phoenix token doesn't get resolved until book three. You know, we see a lot of stuff like that happening here, where you'll have, like, the spirit coins. Cool thing, becomes an issue later, no longer becomes an issue even later, and then re-becomes an issue way later.
Right.
And it's little stuff like that. Like, it's just a little coin, but it's going to have a big role. You know?
It is.
The healing unguent becomes relevant now, stays relevant for a couple of books. Yeah. You know, it's just the amount of planning that he put into this series is insane. I don't think I could ever comprehend something like that.
Well, you could. I think you would just have to do a lot of work to get there, you know, and really, really think about the world you want to write and flesh it out. And, I mean, on that topic of thinking about the world and fleshing it out, though, a lot of the monster names are pretty silly.
A little bit, yeah.
Right? Like, tyrannical pheasant, potent hamster, Shab.
A lot of them are just kind of self-explanatory. Like, flying eel that flies. Pretty simple. Carnivorous mandrake. Mandrake eats people.
Okay, how the hell is a pheasant going to be tyrannical then?
Like, it's very, very mean.
Okay, but like, he's got to be like running a nation or something, or at least a flock of other pheasant.
I don't think flock is appropriate, but I'll accept it. I think it's more of the way it thinks. Like, it thinks like a tyrant, therefore it's tyrannical. But also, who named the tyrannical pheasant, and why that? This dude really hated birds.
Maybe it was someone who got dominated by a pheasant, and so he just viewed him as a tyrant.
That's also possible.
There it is. That's
the way.
A lot of the monster names end up just being portmanteaus, like Shab, Shark, Crab, you know, stuff like that, just similar enough. There are some funny ones that we'll get to later. I think it's in this book we get to later, where it's one they mention that, like, if the names are one way, it's like a perfectly fine monster. If they're the other way, it's a horribly scary monster.
Yeah.
Like, and it's like, who names these things? Like, and it's funny, it's just like, all the monster names are just absurd most of the time. Except for the Vorger. That's a cool name.
That's a cool name, yeah.
That is a cool name. So, anyways, as he's doing his thing and fighting all his silly little monsters, flying eel and whatnot, he's looting every one of these monsters as he goes, and I found it interesting, and I kind of don't even really understand why, but like, the quest system gives him generic loot for these lesser monsters. So like, he gets like 10 coins, a monster core, like maybe some unguent and, you know, like various items, but like a lot of the items generally are like the same items, and it's like this weird like quest system reward thing. And it's like very video gamey, so it's like kind of neat.
It is a lot of video game type aspects here. Helps us keep track of the magic system, helps us keep it going. It basically just feels like a live action video game a lot of the time, and I wouldn't have it any other way personally.
Yeah, and like with all the loot that he's getting, I'm guessing that kind of works its way into that, like condensing all the magic into just generic stuff, like you said with the unguent. Yeah
just about
got you. So now with this interface that does all this cool stuff, I think there is an important element missing.
What is that?
Background music. Because after he beats the ninth monster, all of a sudden, there's a plant in the middle of the road. And all the other plants have been on the sides of the road. So plant in the middle of the road, a little weird. If his interface was cool enough, it would cue some like Dark Souls ass music, because this is like the level one boss.
It is too. It gives big level one boss energy.
I love it.
Yeah, he does. He tries to sneak around it. He's curious about it. He's cautious. He's like, that's not supposed to be. Tries to sneak around it. Almost gets there, and then gets pulled in by a vine to the boss fight.
Yeah, 100%. Like just cue music. That's Skyrim. I don't care. He needs some Skyrim music or something.
He does.
So as this thing grabs him, the first thing in my mind when I heard the term Mandrake is the freaking screaming ones from Harry Potter.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, this fight would be like 10 times worse if it also did that. Because the second he pulled it up, it would knock him out.
Oh, 100%. Assuming it was a baby one, full grown mandrakes, they kill you outright.
Oh, shoot, that's right. Also, random, do we ever see a full grown mandrake in the series of Harry Potter?
Not that I'm aware of.
Like, I know they talk about them to revive the paralyzed folk, but
I don't think we ever encounter a full-size mandrake.
Well, we'll have to hit up the Carlin brothers. That's a podcast that knows. Oh man. But so yeah, he's friggin' fighting this awful plant, and probably one of my favorite lines in the series happens when Heath Miller says, "People are vegetarians." It is like the most non sequitur line, and then it's followed up with him smashing the freaking mandrake over his knee, saying, like, with every hit, just, "Vegetables are not people-tarians." And that is absolutely probably the funniest fucking thing in the series for me. Like,
yes. Oh, dude, I laugh every single time. It is every too time. Good, and that delivery is absolutely flawless.
Yeah, it is so funny, and like big ups to Heath Miller anyway, but big ups to Heath Miller. That dude is so good. His character work is solid and funny, and I love it. I love every bit of it. So he makes a puddle of the mandrake and loots it. And gets probably one of the weirdest items in the series, the suspiciously sharp trowel.
Yes.
And that makes no sense. How is it suspiciously sharp?
Well, you ever used a trowel before?
Yeah.
Are they usually sharp?
Well, no.
That's suspicious.
It's suspicious that they're not sharp?
It's suspicious that this one is. The suspicious sharpness is not, I think, in regards to how sharp it is. It's just suspicious that it's sharp. It's like the sharp is the suspicious, not the level of sharp.
That is definitely a thing I had not thought of, because I definitely thought of it as being sharper than it should be, suspiciously. Like, that's
weird. Why is he so sharp?
Yeah, it's not like this is a suspicious level of sharp. It's this is suspicious.
That is sharp.
Yeah. Yeah.
However, I feel like it could be useful for, like, cutting vines.
That's probably what it's sharp for. I'm gonna be real. This specific trial is designed to increase the health of carnivorous plants.
Right.
Which have a tendency to bite, and as we see, the mandrake has its vines. So if you're tending to your garden and you get vined up, it would be helpful to be able to cut your way out of it. I think it's just this random gardening implement that is now evil. We're just assuming it's evil.
I mean, they literally call it the evil trowel of the blood cult, like, which is absurd.
Well, that's what Jason calls it. He doesn't know any better.
Well, sure, but...
He's admitted many times to being a fool.
So, now, in exploring the maze and you know, the quest rewards of pants and all that good stuff that he's wanting, I feel like as he's going on, he's getting a little tired of trudging through this maze, and he sees something in the distance that really puts it into perspective, both his quest and what he sees. You know what that is?
No.
That aged well. Because you see, he sees a well, and it's old and it's aged, and he's kind of tired. Listen, man, I tried. I was trying to make... You know what I'm going for, right?
I knew what you were going for. There was absolutely no setup to that punchline.
I was trying.
He finds the well. So he gets rid of this mandrake. He gets the trowel. You know, after having conquered the first level boss, he gets to the end of his first quest.
He does.
And finds the well.
He finds something more important than that, though.
What's that?
Pants.
He does find pants.
For finding
the well. He graciously is given pants for finding this well.
Thank God. He can feel slightly better.
Yes, he can. Nice baggy pants going commando style in the desert.
Yes, sir. And as he gets his nice little pants on, all right, one less worry, and he interacts with his well, and his quest system is like, hey, man. This well's got some secrets for you. You want to go down there? By the way, if you do, don't die. And Jason's like, yeah, fuck all that.
Enter the blood cult.
Ah, shit. Of course.
And this is...
Those guys.
This is a pivotal moment in this book, I would say, because he happens to stumble upon some blood cultists looking for their sharp trowel.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what puts him on the path to actually exploring the well, because he has to weigh the options of being stuck with these cannibals or go down the well and see what happens.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting at this point. This is the only time that we see Jason considering rejecting a quest. And his quest system actually allowing him to do it.
Would you say the first time or the only time?
Well, I think this is the only time that his quest system actually allows him to reject the quest, and he wants to. Because I'm assuming quests he can reject. And this time he's actually considering rejecting it. His quest system's like, reject? Maybe.
Yeah, and he's like... Like, in a world where don't die is the option, I don't want to take that option.
Right.
Then dying is a threat up here, too, because we've got blood cultists who know you have their trowel.
Mm-hmm.
And my boy's probably got some other plants he needs to tend to. He's a very gardening kind of boy.
He is. This is the first time we see Dougal make an appearance in the series. And he shows Zack up a couple of times, ultimately meeting his demise as the Builder's Vessel in astral space in book 3. So we go way forward and we re-see Dougal.
I know, and it's so funny when he comes back. And we'll get into that when we get to book 3, but yeah. the way that Dougal's legacy ends and also slightly continues is pretty funny.
It is. It really is. So we meet Derek and Dougal. Jason decides to take his chances with the well, climbs down, and starts exploring the cave that this well lead to.
Yes, and as he goes into this cave, the start to chapter 4, personally, I think is a beautifully written piece of, like, scene setting, because for me, it really put me in the well with Jason, cramped and closed and this and that, and, like, the words that he uses are just, I don't know, they just hit right, you know? Like, these words were just completely, like, the right words to be said to, like, really make you feel like you're in this cramped little well crawling along with Jason, you know?
If you say so.
If I say so.
If you say so. The only two words that he uses here are wet and slimy. And those words are repeated significantly often. I have no issues with Shirtaloom. Okay, if you're watching this, no gripes. This is one of those moments in the book, though, where I would long for maybe another adjective. There are 100 synonyms for wet and for slimy. We could use a couple extra. This is like one of those only times where I was kind of brought out of the book a little bit.
Really?
Yeah, just because those two words keep coming up, and I'm like, okay, yes, I get it. It's wet, but it's also slimy.
Well, what do you expect, dude? Wells are wet and slimy.
Yes, but they're also damp and coated in algae.
That's more than two words. Wet and slimy. That's two words. Simple. Get it done, you know what I mean? Just, it's a simple thing to say. Wet and slimy, you get the point. Because, like I said, more than that, he's talking about the cramp. He's talking about scraping his arms on the walls and how his back hurts and his back's touching the top and blah, 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 blah. Like it's a right. Very, like, it is literally just written out claustrophobia, and it's really freaking cool.
It is. It's a good amount of scene setting with him actually crawling. You get to understand and feel like you're crawling with him. I don't know. I just got an issue with wet and slimy, I guess.
I'll keep that in mind for your next birthday.
It was last year. You already missed it.
What? I said next.
Are we doing those every year now?
Oh, yeah. They rolled them out. It's like the iPhones.
I've got a few phone calls to make after this conversation.
Well, despite your gripes of the wet and slimy, I did like his little traversal through the well. He finds a little lamp, and we basically discover that lesser spirit coins are just the magical's version of, like, AA batteries.
Yeah, they kind of just operate every useful, everyday thing.
And that brings to mind lesser spirit coin operated marital aids. I'm just saying. You saying that that's not a thing in this magical universe?
Why would it be? We have magic.
That's why.
I mean, you could go with that. Use some lesser coins every time you want to get off. Or, hear me out. Or you could hit up Jory's clinic for a little bit of togetherness, Jelly.
Okay, but what if you're a single person?
You can be single together.
Yes.
So he goes through this well, blinds himself with a lamp. Hysterical, because we've all done it. Everybody's done it. Don't pretend like you haven't, because we have.
Everyone's turned the light on themselves.
Yeah. we get through it. Pretty simple exploration of this cave. One way in, one way out. go straight. Reach the door, the big, massive, ominous door.
Yes,
that's going to lead us into this ritual chamber. and that's where chapter 4 pretty much leaves off.
Yes, sir. And that's actually, at least for what we're going to talk about, the actual chapter is going to be the end today. But we do want to do a special little thing that we're going to do here and there. Because you may or may not know, the title of this series, He Who Fights with Monsters, that is a direct quote from Friedrich Nietzsche. And the entire quote being, he who fights with monsters must look to it that he's not become a monster himself. And, you know, when I learned that fact when we were originally writing this podcast and getting the idea going, it kind of made me go, I wonder, you know, I've never really, like, read Nietzsche. I want to, like, check it out and whatnot. And I realized that I think Jason is essentially, like, Friedrich Nietzsche's ideology played out in a character.
Oh, 100%. And we'll go through it here for you guys in just a second, give you an idea of what we're going to keep track of, let you know how we think about it. But this whole book series is basically Friedrich Nietzsche in a fantasy world.
Yeah.
And realizing that, when you realize that, you know, I hadn't even thought about it. I knew the quote. I thought it was cool because Jason's trying this whole time not to become a monster, but this goes
right.
so much deeper.
Like in the fact that, like, dude, like I was picking up on some stuff that I was like, yo, like the way that Jason operates as a character, like just the way he functions as a character is directly operating in one way or another through Friedrich Nietzsche's ideology. Let's start off with just, you know, the overarching idea of nihilism, which on the surface, given that Jason seems to be a very bubbly, kind of upbeat character for the most of it, might not sound like it makes sense at first. Like, what do you mean he's nihilist? If you ever met a nihilist, they're all sad and brooding and this and that. But I think you've got some info on why he might be a nihilist.
Yeah, so it's, you have to look a little bit deeper into what nihilism actually meant to Nietzsche and
right.
how he described being a nihilist. Because a lot of times that does get boiled down into, oh, they're sad, they're a nihilist. And people don't really look that much deeper into it. You know, obviously part of it is nothing matters, everything is fake. You know, emotions don't matter, the world doesn't matter, nothing is real. Which doesn't fit Jason too much as a character. Another big part of it is just rejecting traditional beliefs and values, which he does do very frequently. You know,
yeah.
He's always challenging the people around him, you know, to look at things in a different light, to devalue things that people find inherent value in that he doesn't. You know, we see this with you know, even book one, the big fight that Humphrey and Jason get into about philosophy, and whether or not having power is a thing that's good in the first place. He has a big issue with kneeling to royalty just because mm-hmm. they're royalty. He goes head to head with the gods. You know, I'm not going to bow to a god just because they're here. That's ridiculous.
Right.
They don't have any inherent value. They haven't proven their value to me.
Right.
And that's
so it's kind of on that, like God is dead, but not like literally, because these are like active things, but like, you know, in the sense of like his faith in them is not there. So in his realm, gods are dead.
Yeah. Yeah. Gods are people too.
You know, and if we take that, like, for what Nietzsche meant by it initially, it's, you know, it's not that, it wasn't a literal statement of an entity, a deity being dead, but it was a breakdown of traditional morals. And Jason is a big character for that, because he really doesn't have traditional morals. Now, he does operate by a codex of his own, but he, you know, like, he doesn't operate the way everybody else does. He doesn't do all of that. So he, you know, especially when it comes to, you know, anything dealing with gods. While on Earth, he was, you know, purely, you know, atheist, agnostic, whichever, along those realms, like, you know. But, I mean, more than anything, he was a nihilist at the end of it. He didn't believe in any of that, and his values didn't come from that. So when he meets, like, you know, gods in person, he's like, yeah, man, I don't give a shit about you, because I've never believed in you in the first place. I don't care if you're real.
Right. And that's it, too. And we see him and Farrah get into it a lot, too. Another big part of the nihilism is your objective truths and beliefs and, you know, what actually exists on an objective scale doesn't matter for him. You know, there is no such thing as an objective truth or an objective belief system for Jason. And, you know, morals are what you make them and your own personal moral code. And he does this a lot. Most of it surfaces when he talks about killing people, you know. Mm-hmm. He goes from killing is wrong, period, to killing the right people is okay, you know. And we see a very big transformation of his own personal moral system.
And with that, another element of Nietzsche's ideology, which on face value might seem a bit contradictory, is existentialism. However, because those two things are intertwined, I think that it actually, in a way, gives Jason a bit of a split road. And maybe back on that Robert Frost reference, you know that yellow wood with that split road, he really has the option in this series to lean towards nihilism or lean towards existentialism. Like, if he leans into the nihilism, you know, maybe he becomes an astral being and completely loses all emotion and, you know, no longer, you know, essentially qualifies as, you know, a normal being because he's, you know, he's now emotionless because he's pure nihilism at this point. Yeah. However, given the way this series goes, I think he's going to make the shift into an existentialist because he has existentialism traits already. And I personally think that he's going to fall towards that existentialism more because with that, you know, the entire point of existentialism is overcoming nihilism with, like, personal freedom, responsibilities, and, like, creating your own meanings out of your own life, separate from any, you know, like, religion or people or group. Like, it's you know, it's all from you. Like I exist, you know, I think, therefore I am, almost, but more. But more than that, because like it's like I am, and because I am powerful. Like, you know, and I think that works really well with Jason's, like, way. And I think really I think the trajectory of the series that we're gonna see is Jason go from being a nihilist into an existentialist.
I think so too. And he'll have moments throughout this whole journey where he gets a little bit more existentialist and then reverts back to nihilist, and he bounces back and forth a little bit. Right. We get later on in the books, and, you know, he starts to become more of that freedom is the true path. And if it's meaningful to me, then it has meaning type of reason.
100%. Well, and that's also just Nietzsche's ideology, is like, if you give it meaning, then it has meaning, you know?
Exactly.
Like, you know, create meaning out of a nothingness. Because he believed that, you know, there was nothing. And we see that Jason, that was exactly Jason's beliefs on Earth, is there was nothing. Like,
yeah,
he was just here to be here. And now he gets out there, and, like, I think that's why he actually is such a nihilist, is, you know, his old life was so dull and plain, and there was just nothing for him, nowhere for him to go, nothing for him to do. He's literally just nothing.
Yeah.
And this actually brings up the next point on the Nietzsche ideology, is the will to power. And I think, you know, using the will to power, Jason will navigate from nihilism into existentialism, because, I mean, will to power is pretty much self-explanatory. It is literally just willing yourself to get as much power as you possibly can. And
self-assertion, self-growth, expanding influence. This is all stuff that Jason goes through. It's a pretty big theme for him, especially in these early books, because he gets into this world, like with the hamster biting on his head, he has no power, and he has to figure out how to get power just to stay alive, and that becomes his means of progression. You know, he is always needing more power. He is always needing more control, and that drives him, literally drives him into becoming an existentialist, and then growing on further, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And another, I think, element that we can add to layer this more, because, like I said, dude, it's so crazy how layered this Nietzsche ideology. Like when I started it, I did not, like, when I had the initial idea, I was like, oh, there's not, like I can't be that much, but it is so in there. Because another element that we can see is in his desire, because that goes into, like, the master/slave morality, master morality and slave morality.
Yeah, this is one of the biggest things that I found while we were doing our research. It's just so interesting when it pertains to this book, because it's two very different ways of thinking. You know, you have the master morality, which is where you value your strength, nobility, self-affirmation. You are basically the patriarch of your life. And then you have the slave morality, where you're very more compassionate. You value humility and resentment and stuff. This is a weird dichotomy that plays out in Jason throughout the entire book, because he is put in a position where he needs to have that master morality mindset. He needs to grow stronger. He needs to be, you know, responsible for things. And he needs the ability to get that done. And the entire series, he's, you know, talking about how he wishes he could be compassionate, how he wishes he could just be some other guy.
Right.
You know, he wants to be able to be the guy that doesn't have to kill people, that doesn't need to be responsible for people.
Yeah.
And it's a whole inner struggle with himself, and that's, he tells everybody else that he encounters, you know, hey, you need to be compassionate, you need to be, you know, merciful,
right?
But he can't afford to do that himself, and it's a huge struggle even into book 11.
It is. And so, like, and I think a lot of it just comes down to his way of thinking, and the issue for him is he'll never be able to achieve that, because his line of thinking, you know, even before he got brought into this world, when he was on Earth, like, a lot of stuff that happened to him shaped his mind into this, you know, master morality, where he's got, you know, like he believes himself higher and better. And in little ways, obviously, when he's on Earth, but it grows more and more and more. But he sees that, you know, that's not the, like, he doesn't want to live like that. He wants to live that slave mentality, that slave morality, where he's just worried about compassion and this and that. But, you know, that's like, you know, he's a sword, essentially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like it's essentially the difference between a sword and a shield. Like, his morality is a sword and slave morality is a shield, and he just literally, it's apples to oranges. Sword's the shield. Yeah. It's like,
yeah, he wants to be the shield, but he's got a blade. And that's a huge deal for him. And we'll talk about it a little bit more in depth when we get there in the books, because this is a huge factor, you know, in books 4 and 5 for him. And we get a lot of talking about it, kind of talking around the topic with Arabelle and the counseling that he has to go through when he gets back to Imoras. And we'll break it down hardcore when we get there.
Yeah, definitely. So there's only a couple little things, I think, left that we need to talk about. Just two simple little things. First one in this ideology is the thought of eternal recurrence, which is, you know, Nietzsche kind of believed that you would be constantly regenerating and coming back to life. And I think it could be in a metaphorical way.
Yeah.
But in the series, it also kind of ends up being a literal way as well.
Yeah, a lot of these philosophical ideas get more of a physical manifestation in the series. You know, the biggest one for eternal recurrence is, you know, the idea that you're repeating the same life over and over again is really just a description of Jason Star Phoenix ability. You know, every time he dies, he comes back and he continues to fight. The biggest one we see in book 11, right near the end, where he's fighting for the Sundered Throne, and it's just a battle. You know, it's him and a couple of astral beings against the rest of the astral beings. Now, it's a battle. They fight. Jason dies. He gets resurrected. They have lunch. And then they go back to fighting that same battle. And it happens over and over again. He's stuck in this loop for, a decade almost?
Yeah, I think so. He's
grinding his way to gold. And that is just a physical manifestation of the recurrences.
Yeah, exactly.
Big, big part of it.
And I mean, essentially, I think a better way to describe Nietzsche's thought, though, is that it's a forged in fire kind of situation. Like,
100%.
You're gonna go through shit. A part of you is gonna die in a way, and then you're gonna come back, but you're gonna be stronger. And it's just that eternal recurrence and. If you're focused on it, you can achieve that. And I think, you know, that's what we're seeing with Jason as a character. And then, obviously, all of what we just mentioned is building up to what is obviously the entire point of Jason as a character. And that is the ever-popular, ever-debated Nietzsche's idea of the Übermensch or the Superman, and which is essentially just an ideal human with full control over his life, over his thoughts, over his actions, he's mastered his shit and affirms his existence essentially. He is perfect super god human, and you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, it's just the absolute best version of yourself that you can be, you know, master of yourself in your life. And this is what Jason is working towards, this entire series constantly. You know, it's being that nihilist with the existentialism to kind of interact with it. It's having that master morality when you need to, with the compassion of the slave morality. It is just a combination of everything. The way that, you know, Jason lives in the end is going to be some form of, he is the ultimate version of himself that he can be. And he is the person that can choose to let people live when he needs to and not feel bad about it. And I think that's what this whole series is going to build to.
Yeah, I think so. I think so for sure. And so at the end of the day, I think this whole thing really is going to be Jason playing out Nietzsche's theology, and wherever the end goal is going to get us, whatever. But I think it's going to be a fun thing to pay attention to. And,
oh, yeah,
you know, freaking everybody out there, like, I haven't heard the Reddit really talking about any of this or any else in the community. So, I mean, I'd love to hear from the community about this. Like, it'd yes. be really cool to talk and see, you know, like, because if anything, I feel like Shirtaloon just kind of wanted to get people to think more. And I think it's fantastic. And Shirtaloon's a kind of a philosophizer in his own right in that way.
He is too.
I think.
We're all philosophers in the end.
Hell yeah. So.
Yeah, we'll definitely keep track of it.
Yeah, we will. But yeah. I think it's going to do it for this episode.
That is. We met Jason. We explored a maze. We explored a well. And we explored ourselves.
Good Lord. That was terrible. I do that every terrible. Time.
Every time.
All right. Well, I've been D. Allen.
I've been Donnie B. Thanks for joining us. And we'll see you next week.
Yes, sir. Catch us on He Who Writes With Monsters. We're on Facebook, Twitter, all the things. We're on the things.
We're on everything. You'll find us.
Find us.